Welcome back in to another edition of the Fifth Down Podcast. I am your host, Mike Fiella. I have a jam-packed show for you all today. In First Down, I am joined by Scott Hansen of the NFL Network and of the NFL Red Zone Channel to discuss some of the big storylines at the end of the football season. And we analyze what do some of those impacts that occurred mean for teams going forward with a focus on free agency. In Second Down, I am joined by Professor Thomas Talvage from Purdue University. He is the head of the neurotrauma division. He is one of the world's foremost leaders on head trauma in football. And with the changes to the NFL rules and the new concerns on player safety, especially with the deaths of former players such as Junior Seau, he's a great guest to bring on to give you a scientific perspective about what's going on in the NFL. In Third Down, I talked to Brian Martin, the head of the Test Football Academy, an institute created to help players in their preparation for the combine and draft process, in addition to improving veteran performance year to year. Star clients include Super Bowl MVP Joe Flacco, quarterback of the Baltimore Ravens, and Patrick Peterson, the cornerback of Arizona Cardinals. But there are two students this year which are creating a ton of buzz for Test, and we gauge their performance in the eyes of Brian Martin. In Fourth Down, I give you my take on Norlens Noel. He is the star forward for the University of Kentucky, a shot blocker extraordinaire. Tore his ACL last night, and it has yet again brought up, should college players be paid? This coming on the tail end of the Jadeveon Clowney debate. Some believe Clowney, who is projected to be the first overall pick in next year's NFL draft. We already heard Jason McKee say he thinks he can play in the NFL and be dominant today, earlier this year on this show. Some think Clowney should not play. But without further ado, let's hop in to First Down. Into First Down now, I am joined by Scott Hansen. He is the host of the NFL Red Zone Channel, one of the best inventions in the sporting TV landscape, as well as working for the NFL Network. Scott, how are you?
Doing real well, Michael. How are you doing?
I'm great. Thanks for coming on the show. We have a lot to talk about the NFL world since the Super Bowl is buzzing, just like it is every week. The first thing I'd like to get your take on was, even though it's a couple weeks out, separate from the blackout, which a lot of people will talk about for the Super Bowl, what were some of the things you saw from Colin Kaepernick, the quarterback that lost the game, or the, on the team that lost the game, that may be encouraging moving on?
Well, it may be encouraging moving on. I mean, the dude, hey, he counted for, what, three total touchdowns in that game. When they came down to the final goal line stand, I don't think it was poise that was a factor. So I think if there was a factor in them not scoring, it was physical execution. And then, you know, obviously Niner fans would claim that there was a penalty that wasn't called that prevented them from scoring to win the game. Kaepernick was in his 10th start, and he'll probably never have a bigger start. And here's why. Even if he makes it back to the Super Bowl next year, if he's starting in that game, it's hard to think that it's a bigger start the second time around than it would be the first time. You know, as for all intents and purposes, him being a rookie, he's not a rookie, but I mean, in terms of playing time and starting wise, he was basically a rookie in that game. So for him to maintain his poise throughout the Niners NFC Championship run, and then really through the entire 60 minutes of the game, I think that's a great sign going forward.
I think Kaepernick, after the blackout, he seemed to be much more adjusted to the game. It seemed early on he was missing some throws that he would normally have made. But to your point, he is essentially a rookie. He is very young, and he has a very bright future. The flip side of the ball, the other quarterback, Joe Flacco, played tremendous. He is definitely in line for a great paycheck. There are high demands for him in terms of he wants to be the $20 million quarterback. That's a lot of money for a quarterback, but it's not my money. I'm not going to tell anyone how to spend it. But that is a high asking price. We assume that Flacco will be with the Ravens. Do you think there's any chance that he's not?
No. He's absolutely going to be a Baltimore Raven. At least this upcoming season, because if he clings to $20 million annual asking price, and if Ozzie Newsome, the general manager of the Ravens, balks at that, then ultimately Ozzie will say, well, son, you're playing this year under the franchise tag, and they will slap it on him. He'll still make great coin doing that, but he won't get the long-term security that he's looking for. I actually think so he's absolutely going to be a Raven this upcoming season. I really think that they're going to get a long-term deal done, and I don't necessarily think it's going to end up at about $20 million because, you know, I mean, if Raheem Moore from the Denver Broncos, the safety, knocks that pass down, then the Broncos win that game, most likely, and the Ravens are bounced out in the second round of the playoffs, and we're not even having this discussion about Joe Flacco thinking he's a $100 million quarterback, right?
That's 100%
true. That being said, it happened. And he did what he did. And he had one of the greatest playoff runs in history. And they won the Super Bowl. What more do you want out of a quarterback? You know? And he's been doing it quite well. Not always consistent, but quite well for years in Baltimore. They'll almost certainly get a long-term deal done. I don't think it would happen until maybe right before training camp. Everyone loves to drag their heels in the offseason. But I think they'll get something done.
What do you think the Flacco contract means for the Ravens' defense? They have already lost Ray Lewis due to retirement. There's been rumblings and grumblings that they may cut Anquan Boldin, the wide receiver, and Ed Reed, they may lose him as well. Do you think the Ravens will look drastically different next season, or will Ozzie Newsome figure out how to make it all work?
Well, if anyone can figure it out, it'd be Ozzie, but keeping a Super Bowl team together is arguably harder than putting one together. It almost never happens. I mean, these days, the reigning Super Bowl champ almost always meets with some type of difficulty or adversity that it's just not able to overcome the next season. Whether that be just feeling high and mighty about yourself, or whether that is actual personnel moves because everyone thinks they have a part in the success, and in a true team sport, everyone did have a part in the team's success, but other teams are willing to come in and maybe overpay a Super Bowl champion from the Baltimore Ravens to come get them on their roster than the Ravens are willing to pay to retain them. You know, and they're dealing with the same salary cap where it's like the Ravens are trying to keep their team together as one unit where 31 other teams might come and poach one or two guys from here or there. Yeah, they're going to be a different team. I mean, I don't think anyone's going to predict them to repeat. I really don't, because I think most people think this is kind of a magical playoff run that they got on. They're always going to be John Harbaugh's maybe the best coach in the game right now, maybe even passing Bill Belichick with some of the small details that he just takes care of. You know, if Flacco gets locked up long term, and if he progresses, he could become an elite quarterback. Ray Rice is one of the better running backs in the game, but there's still other holes there that suggest that this team won't be able to maintain that level of success. And maybe one of the biggest ones is they play one of the hardest divisions in the game. You know, the Bengals are a playoff team. We know the Steelers are perennially a playoff team, even though a down year this past year. And the Browns are young and maybe getting better too. And just the recent history of the NFL suggests uneasy is the head that wears the crown, because everyone's gunning for you, and usually you don't see success in that next year.
That's true. It is extremely difficult to repeat. Even teams that seem to have the perfect balance of youth and veteran talent, like the Packers a couple years ago, they had difficulties repeating. The Giants have had two Super Bowls in the past 5 years, and it's been extremely difficult for them to even make the playoffs the year after. Another team in flux is the Philadelphia Eagles. They bring in Chip Kelly from Oregon, a coach that Pac-12 fans know extremely well. They re-sign Michael Vick. It is very early to tell in the process here, but what should viewers expect to see from the Eagles? It won't obviously be exactly like Oregon. The game is different, but what can or what should some people look towards to see in the Eagles offense?
You know what? I'm telling you right now, I don't think anybody knows. And I'm going to put Chip Kelly in that group. I don't think anybody knows what the Eagles' offense is really going to look like this year, because it can't be what Oregon ran. It almost can't be. You just no quarterback would survive that long, and the kids that he had at Oregon had such specific skill sets and were that much better than most of the opponents they played against, speed wise, and then you know schematically as well. There's not that margin of talent gap in the NFL, and there's certainly not that margin of coaching difference. You know, there are not people reinventing the wheel and just being eons ahead of everyone else when it comes to putting 11 guys on the field on offense. You know, they locked up Michael Vick for this season, so you would almost certainly think he's going to be the guy. Kelly says, I'm not naming him the guy. I want to see Nick Foles. I want to see Vick in practice. And someone's going to win the job during the season or during the preseason. But I don't know. I can't imagine they're running a snap every 18 seconds, every 22 seconds, whatever Oregon was averaging at their fastest pace. And I just don't think you see the quarterback running quite as much either. I will like to see DeSean Jackson in that role. In fact, I talked to DeSean at the Super Bowl. He was there endorsing some products and bumped into him, and he said usually college guys compare themselves to pro guys.
Right.
DeSean was like, no, I want to be the Black Mamba in this offense. DeAnthony Thomas or whatever his name is.
Yeah, DeAnthony Thomas.
Yeah, DeAnthony Thomas. His name slipped my mind there for a second. You know, a.k.a. the Black Mamba in that Oregon offense. DeSean's like, that's the role I want to play. But that was kind of an interesting, you know, turnabout there with a pro guy talking about a college guy like that. But I think if anything can fit well or kind of one-to-one that we might expect out of Kelly's offense from Oregon to the Eagles, it might be DeSean Jackson. He'd be fun to watch, that's for sure.
That's true. I have seen Oregon live twice, having the pleasure to watch them demolish the Sun Devils, both in person in Oregon and in Tempe. They are phenomenal. They have so many athletes, and the speed difference is, it's outrageous. TV doesn't do it justice. That's how prominent the speed difference is. But you're right, their coaching and the athletes are so much different in the NFL. It will be interesting to see what the Eagles can do. In their division, however, is the Dallas Cowboys, a team with tremendous talent, but they were unable to put it together again due to injuries. And quite frankly, Tony Romo did not play well when the moments were biggest at the end of the season. A lot of fans clamored for a quarterback change. That's probably just raw emotion because, frankly, there is not a better quarterback out there in free agency than Romo that you could get, assuming Flacco is a Baltimore Raven. What do we see from the Cowboys, who have had a lot of changes, especially on the defensive side of the ball?
You know, Dallas, they're everybody's favorite team to talk about because most people love them or hate them. Romo is not the problem there. And you know, I'm surprised I'm saying this at the end of the season. Dez Bryant is not the problem there. Now,
true.
I'm going to keep Dez, you know, on the straight and narrow in holistically in his life. But Dez proved to be the player that they had hoped he was going to be. I mean, he had some of his best games when he had a finger that was just mangled. That broken finger was nasty, and he did not miss time. And not only that, but thrived in that offense. They are stripping Jason Garrett of his play calling duties, and that to me is a pretty serious step because the argument is that Jason Garrett is the head coach of the Cowboys because of his play calling ability. At least what they used to think of it. I mean, heck, he was going to be the head coach of the Baltimore Ravens at one time before Harbaugh got the job because he was supposedly the golden child, and Jerry Jones stepped up and made him one of the highest-paid coordinators in the game and the coach-in-waiting, if you will. And then when they parted ways with Wade Phillips, they said, you know, obviously Jason's our guy, but he hasn't taken them where they need to go either. You know, the Cowboys... You know, I want to see what they become on defense. I thought that Rob Ryan was going to get that thing right, but they had a lot of injuries, and that defensive backfield is still kind of a mess. They've addressed it a lot through the draft, free agency, and whatnot. I think they got some ability back there, but it still has not been the big play secondary that they need to complement that offense. That being said, You know, the Giants fell apart last year at critical times. So you can take that whole division in the NFC East and scramble them up in a bag and throw them out there, and it would not surprise me if the Cowboys are the team standing tall at the end. They've been this close the last 2 years.
And they are two horrific interceptions by Tony Romo away from probably winning that game. I mean, they started the game off in Washington with just an atrocious interception by Tony Romo, but I agree with you. He gets a lot of grief for not making the play at the right time occasionally, but people forget about how many times he makes plays or he keeps the Cowboys in the game. He is the ultimate paradox, because what makes him phenomenal is also what occasionally leads to his downturn, which is his ability to make something out of nothing.
Yep. And, you know, the other thing is he's a paradox between the regular season and the playoffs, or the regular season and then late regular season when the games matter the most. I still say that Tony Romo, and I think you started off the topic by saying, you know, the way I put it is this, and I say this about head coaches too. If you got somebody better, go get them. If you got somebody better, put them in. Okay, there is nobody better on that roster. There is nobody better available to the Cowboys. Tony Romo's your guy. Ride with him.
For the New York Jets, a team that has had a lot of turmoil caused by head coach Rex Ryan, he is back with the team. They have overhauled the entire front office, changed the offensive coordinator, but they are still sticking with Mark Sanchez, with the most prominent, prolific, in terms of name value, backup quarterback on the roster. First, what do we see, or what do you see from Tim Tebow going forward? Is he a guy that you think can play in the league? He just needs an opportunity. And B, if it's not Tebow, what do you think about Mark Sanchez?
Yeah, well, no, Tim Tebow almost certainly will not be there, you know, next year. I mean, like probably 99.9% certain. Now, whether or not he gets a shot in the league is the main question. I think if you put him in, I think he's a better player when the real bullets are flying than he could ever demonstrate in any other aspect of football. 7-on-7 skeleton drills, just regular 11-on-11 practice, training camp, preseason games. When it counts, he has no conscience whatsoever. He's calm. He's gonna do everything he can to make the play. He's physically stronger than virtually every other quarterback in the league, so he can maybe shake a defender that has a beat on him for a sack and whip it downfield. But on a 3, 5, and 7 step regular drop with a clear sight lane, he'll skip the ball to a wide receiver on an all too regular basis, and that scares every coach in the league and every offensive coordinator in the league, or at least most of them. So I don't know where he's going to get a chance at. I don't know where he's going to get a chance at. I think if somebody really had, someone's really got to be secure in their job as a coach to take him on and have a strong locker room, it would not surprise me. It would not surprise me if he is one of, if not the backup to Tom Brady next year in New England. Bill Belichick has done things of that nature before, along the lines of, you know, Ocho Cinco, or even going back even further, like Corey Dillon was supposedly, you know, toxic material, and you weren't going to bring him in the locker room. It would shake things up, but he came in there and played well. Then Joey Galloway and other players that came in there, and Belichick and the Patriots were able to take him on, and they found some type of role for him. Wouldn't surprise me at all if Tebow's in New England. But you know what? You'd always leave the ratings. I'll say this. You always leave the ratings on a high note. And I got to get running right now. But when you end on Tim Tebow, that's a high note, because I guarantee you nobody clicks off when you're talking about the quarterback that's taking the league by storm in the first 3 years.
That's absolutely true. Scott, thanks a lot for coming on the show. I really appreciate it.
You got it, Michael. All the best.
Into Second Down now. I am joined by Professor Thomas Tavlidge at the Purdue Neurotrauma Group, one of the world's foremost authorities on brain injuries, with the news in the sporting world between the lawsuits in the NFL, the head injuries, and the constant concern on concussions. We brought in the professor here to discuss what's going on. Professor, how are you?
I'm doing well. How are you doing?
I'm good. I cannot complain. The topic in which we brought you in to discuss head injuries. What is the main concern that players have with brain injuries? Is there one main culprit or are there multiple culprits?
So the big thing that has led to a lot of the recent attention has been the documentation in a number of ex-football players from the NFL, and historically this has been observed previously in boxers rather regularly, of chronic traumatic encephalopathy. And this is a neurodegenerative disorder, so essentially the brain starts to die. And as it dies, it's occurring generally fairly early in life. And as a result, there have been observations in many players that they have a lot of early onset Alzheimer's, a lot of early onset dementia, and then certainly in many of these high-profile cases, such as Junior Seau, Dave Duerson, Chris Henry, Owen Thomas from the University of Pennsylvania, we find that a lot of these players then are essentially committing suicide or dying in unusual circumstances, typically because of erratic behavior that seems to be associated with this neurodegeneration.
How do you counteract the damage? Is there a way to reverse it or pause it? Or is once the damage happens, it's pretty much a matter of time?
As best as has been determined, once this particular CTE starts, there is nothing that can be done, because once it has begun, the cells are actually dying. And once the cells are gone, the brain has the ability to recover function and rebuild cells, but it's a very slow process. And at the rate and the extent of the injuries that have been observed in many of these players, particularly even the relatively younger players, such as Seau or Duerson, who are only in their 40s and 50s, there's really nothing that can be done for them.
That is essentially it for them. Once they have this illness, once they have this disease, there is nothing that anyone can really do. It is permanent, right? It's very similar in the sense like an ALS. They don't have a cure yet. There's no way to reverse it.
That's correct. There's really nothing they can do to reverse it. I mean, there's a lot of hope that maybe they'll be able to slow the spread of the disease. But at this point, I think the main focus, at least our main focus, has been on, and that of a number of other research groups, has been on trying to understand how to prevent these players from reaching this state, because that's, I think, our best hope in the future.
So what is the main way that you can prevent this? Padding in the helmets? Is it an entirely new helmet design? Is it limiting the number of hits? What is the way in which players can play football in the manner that it has been played or the manner that they want to play without these severe health risks?
One of the big issues is, the focus from the NFL, the focus from the National Institutes of Health, the focus from the Institute of Medicine, has been a focus on concussions. And one of the big things about CTE is that, in fact, the extent of the observed CTE does not generally correlate well with the history of diagnosed concussions and may not correlate well even with the history of, in truth, real concussions that have actually been experienced. So it appears, rather, that a lot of the consequence from the CTE and a lot of these other early-onset dementia-type cases are from, accumulated total hits. From our own study thus far in high school players, we are not observing that the changes we see in brains are terribly related to the magnitudes of the hits that the players take, but they are far more strongly related to the number of hits that they take and the locations on the head in which they get struck or which they strike other players. So from our own perspective, there's a lot of value in reducing the energy in there, because at some level the magnitude matters, but what may matter the most is just simply reducing the sheer number of blows that the kids are taking.
Which parts of the head are weakest? Which parts of the head are strongest? Because you said that depending on where they get hit in the head, the damage could be different.
What we at least find is that we get greater brain changes, and I think this is expected, it's consistent with boxing literature, for example, that hits to the side of the head tend to be more obviously damaging. Those tend to create injuries that are more likely to be symptomatic and therefore observed and identified as concussions. But we also find that when our players who take a lot of hits and who don't exhibit symptoms but do then exhibit substantial numbers of brain changes, those brain changes tend to be most related to hits either to the top front of the head, so that would be above the face mask getting toward the crown of the helmet, or hits on the back side of the helmet. And that's potentially players falling down and landing on their head, hitting their head, or that could also be consistent with players who are for example, going up for a ball, they get hit abruptly, their body stops, and their head whiplashes forward and back. And that's, I say that as if that's a blow, because the sensors that are used in all of these helmets are simply accelerometers. So they tell you that the head moved and changed its direction and changed its velocity, but they do not actually tell you whether a blow to the head truthfully existed.
So what is the difference between a hit and a blow to the head? You know, would a hit be you maybe clacked helmets with somebody and the trench is not too hard, and a blow would be you took a full-blown shot maybe from a safety as you come across the middle?
That will certainly change the magnitude of the blow, but by hit or blow, we really mean the same thing. There's not a lot of difference. The main issue is the acceleration that actually takes place in the head. There's a classical perspective that when the head accelerates or changes or stops, for example, a strong negative acceleration, deceleration, that the brain starts rattling around inside of the skull and bouncing off the front and back. This is a popular thing that several of the researchers like to show in their talks. It's actually completely false. The brain is held inside the skull by the meninges, which are a soft tissue that attach it and essentially help cushion it. But it then has attachment points. So what you actually get when you have an acceleration is that parts of the brain are essentially tethered, and they can't go anywhere. So you start getting other regions of the brain that will stretch or compress. And it seems to be this stretching and compression of the brain tissue that matters. Now, when you get hit in different parts of your head, that's going to result in different forces on the overall brain and therefore different regions of the brain that get stretched or get compressed. And it's possible, based on the fact that our brain has a lot of different folds in it, that some directions of force may be more damaging than others.
So the easy answer would be to absolutely reduce or limit the amount of hits. But football coaches, and I would probably argue football players at some point, would not like that, because that means they're playing less. And for coaches, they're not getting the best performance out of their player. But the flip side of that argument would be, with the increased hits, you run the risk of higher injury. So is there a safe number of hits? Is there an allotted number of hits in which damage occurs and regeneration can happen? Or does regeneration not happen at all?
We actually have seen in our players that players who accumulated over the course of about a 12-week season fewer than 700 blows over the course of that period, so that's about 50 blows a week, 60 blows per week, top end, about 4 to 5 months after the season, they look pretty much like they did before the season. But players who are experiencing, say, 900 blows or more over the course of that season, so we're talking there, 80-some blows per week or above, they are not recovering as rapidly or as well. So it kind of suggests that there is definitely a number below which whatever level of accumulated damage exists is very likely recoverable. It may take an extended period of time, which you'd anticipate in the brain, but it does look like there's at least a level below which you can recover most of whatever damage takes place. And what that means is it's not that there's per se a safe level. There possibly is, though we can't confirm that yet. But at least it says that if we can reduce the level of damage to be reparable within a 4 or 5 month period, and we can get the kids to really do no contact for 5, 6 months after their season ends, odds are pretty good they can go through, a good number of years of play without setting themselves up for substantial long-term damage. And I think that's got to be an initial goal. So, reduce the number of hits, keep it down at this controlled level, at least until we understand better how the specific magnitudes of accelerations play into this, until we understand how specific locations of blows play into this, and until we really update the protective equipment to make it be effective. I think in some sense, kind of like in baseball, pitch counts have become kind of a knee-jerk reaction to keeping pitchers healthy, but we really don't have a good understanding of how many times can a particular individual pitcher throw pitches under a stressful situation before he gets damaged. I think the same thing is happening here, so it may be a good initial rule of thumb. Let's try to keep hits below a particular number, maybe 60, 70 hits per week. And then as we come to a better understanding of how each of those individual blows affects the brain, I think then we can start changing that and go to a much more player-specific guideline.
Is there a position on the field that sees this CTE or these brain injuries more? I would think a linebacker, maybe a fullback, or the offensive and defensive lines probably see that more than a wide receiver or defensive back.
You know, I'm not entirely clear if Dr. McKee at Boston has managed to identify enough of these players to get a good sense for that, but certainly the original players in whom this has been identified have been either linemen, particularly offensive linemen, and also linebackers, particularly kind of these middle linebackers, and safeties. And these are, in fact, individuals who tend to be involved. We see in a lot of high-force collisions. So that's why, you know, I kind of hedged earlier. Magnitude clearly must play a role in this, because otherwise I don't think we'd be seeing these defensive backs and linebackers getting so much damage. But also sheer number has to play a role, or else we wouldn't really expect the linemen to be having an effect. So it's, you know, in some sense, it's an integral under the curve, we suspect, where it's the magnitude and the number you're taking. You add that up, you get a problem. So linemen and then these high-force-hitting positions seem to be at the greatest risk thus far.
The NFL and scientists like yourself, researchers, figured out the damages to the brain, because I would think there's a lot of lawsuits out there that brain injuries are part of the territory in playing in the NFL, just like ACLs, MCLs. Now, the damage to your knee, per se, is not nearly as devastating to your head. But when did this happen? Because it seems to me in these past year or so, there's been a very big push.
You know, it's a great question. Odds are good this has been existing all along, but it has probably become more pronounced in recent years for a couple of issues. Number one, the guys are just much bigger. They are much faster. You know, to be honest, there is also a potential confounding issue of steroids and HGH usage by who knows what percentage of the players. It's possible that's actually contributing to this. That's unclear. But just simply from a raw mechanics perspective, you've got bigger, faster players today than you had 40 years ago. And 40 years ago, you had a helmet that pretty much had a little, leather suspension inside of it with a metal helmet. When you hit somebody, that helmet slammed down onto your head, and it hurt.
Right.
It cut you. So you tended not to do that. Today's helmet is this, you know, high-tech plastic structure with all this padding inside, and I think the players feel safer, which results in them trying to hit with their head more, and as a consequence, I think we're starting to see more and more effects in the long term or even in the near term, because the players are probably experiencing more and worse head blows today than they did 40, 50 years ago.
In the short term, how does that affect a player in terms of, let's think of a college or a high school player, how would that affect their academics, their GPA, their grades, and maybe on a pro level, how would that affect their ability to process information? Is it noticeable, the difference in a year?
So what we typically have found in our players, for those players who are asymptomatic, players who are not exhibiting symptoms that would classically get them identified as being concussed, the deficits we observe are generally in terms of their visual processing stream. Their visual working memory seems to be weaker than it is prior to their contact activities. And they also tend to be using alternate pathways in their brain to achieve relatively straightforward tasks. So what this all suggests is that their brains are operating at a lower efficiency. So academically, you'd expect that maybe they wouldn't notice it on any given daily basis, but after an exam, they may be a little more tired or a little more stressed or a little more worn than they normally would be. And if it came to a period where they had to give very, you know, long-term exertion and long-term focus, for example, standardized testing, that could be an area where these players would now be suffering. They also are likely to be having a little bit harder time picking up concepts that are, say, visual spatial, like mathematics concepts or physics concepts. So that could certainly have an effect on them academically. And then that does lead to, okay, now let's take the pro player, for example. Now you're dealing with an individual who may just not be reading what the offense or what the defense is doing quite as well as you'd like them to. You may get a little more of a blown coverage or more blown coverages than you would under normal circumstances, because they just aren't processing that visual scene and parsing it quite as effectively as they should be.
You're saying ultimately it's in the best interest of the schools, of the teams, of the leagues to get a handle on this for not only the player's sake, but for the sport in general, because the game is only getting more complex. The teams are only scoring quicker and quicker when defenses make mistakes. So they obviously want their players at a peak level. This past week, the president of the United States came out and said that he wouldn't let his sons, if he had sons, play football. Bernard Pollard, one of the hardest hitters in the league and Baltimore Ravens safety, said the same thing. You study this stuff every day on a daily basis. You are an expert. Would you let your son play football. Do you think it's safe, or do you think that this is a bad idea, the trend that we are heading towards?
Yeah, Bernard, he's one of our alums, of course. but yeah, that's a great, good question, and the answer is unfortunately somewhat nuanced. Right now, no, I don't. My son does not play football, partly because he plays soccer, which may not be that much better because there's no protection on the head, and they still get hit pretty hard by the ball. And he plays baseball, and he does gymnastics, which probably will result in a good number of shocks to the head as he plays. So I can't quite argue on the basis of shocks and such that I would not allow him to play football. But at the same time, I think, and this is something I think every parent should be doing anyway, and almost every parent probably does, which is that when you're going to have your child play a game like football, you want to actually be aware of what the coaches are doing in practice, what the coach's philosophy is, and probably observe to see what happens. And if you're comfortable with what they're doing, go ahead and let your child play. I know in my son's case, I certainly observed, some of the Little Giants football that goes on at his school. And, with one of the teams I observed, one of the grade levels, I certainly would not let him play because they were teaching very bad tackling technique, if they were teaching it at all. And there were large numbers of head-to-head, helmet-to-helmet contacts going on in practices just throughout the entire week. Conversely, when I watched one of our other teams, the coaches for that team were teaching very good technique, working very hard and ensuring that players lead with their shoulder, wrap with their arms, so that whatever head contact occurs is incidental to the fact that the head's close to the shoulders and the arms.
Right.
And so if he were in that grade level, I would actually be willing to let him play if he wanted to. I'd still probably go out and get my own helmet more from what we're working on as a research group rather than any of the current extant helmets, just because I think what we're working on is better. But, it would certainly be something I'd be willing to let him do.
And finally, before we get you out of here, professors, is this a problem starting at a very young age, or is this a problem that can develop or just sporadically develops? Is it there a certain number of hits that makes this occur, or is that just too early in the process to know?
What we do know is that the players look, by the time they get to our study as sophomores in high school, which is typically when we start picking them up, they already look very different from their high school classmates who do not regularly participate in contact sports. What that says is that if these kids have been playing for a large number of years by the time they're getting to us, and they typically have, so when we're getting them, they're 15 years old, they've probably been playing younger Pop Warner, Little Giants, 56ers type football since they were, 8, 9.
Right.
So they've got 6, 7 years worth of experience already under their belt. We already see structural changes in their brains. So this does start young, and I think this is one of the reasons that Pop Warner has, I believe they outlawed contact, at least in practice, for all the kids under 10 years old, if I recall correctly. I think that's a really great idea, and I think it's that type of consideration that needs to move forward, because I think if we can reduce the damage that the kids are taking when they're young, particularly at an age then when they're very small relative to their helmet size and they have poor technique, I think we have a good opportunity to then help protect these kids, at least until they're bigger and they start to understand the risks and their parents really understand the risks and they have the physical body size to have a little more control over what's happening.
That, I think, would come with more research. People like you and your group will figure that out. I'm fairly confident. Professor, thanks a lot for coming on the show. Where can my listeners find some more information about what you and your group are working on?
Certainly. Our website is just simply HTTP. It's www.purdue.edu. That's Purdue with a U, not the E, like the chicken on the East Coast. Purdue.edu/research/PNG. And so, or just look on the web for Purdue Neurotrauma Group, and you will find us. And we have a lot of our information up there, and we're always happy to answer emails.
Professor, thanks a lot.
You're very welcome.
Into third down now. I am joined by Brian Martin of the Test Football Academy. He is here to discuss what do some of the college athletes do to prepare for the combine in addition to how they help veterans. Brian, how are you?
I'm doing great, Mike. How are you?
I'm great. Thanks a lot for coming on the show. Let's dive right in here. The first thing I'd like to ask you about is, what does the Test Football Academy do, and how does that help players?
Well, we've been preparing athletes since 1992 for the NFL Combine and also for their veterans for their seasons. We basically do everything we can to enhance speed, agility, power, strength, nutrition, and we also do a lot of positional work with former pros.
When you have a guy, let's say a defensive back, and he wants to improve his speed, what are some of the drills or some of the things that you guys do to help him improve his draft stock?
Well, one of the first things we do is, you know, we work with Patrick Peterson, the top five pick, who's just played in the Pro Bowl, and with Kyle Wilson, who's a first rounder out of Boise State with the Jets. And, you know, these are guys that, you know, are incredible athletes. They're very fast. You know, we do something called a functional movement screen where we evaluate any imbalances they might have right to left. We work on their flexibility, their mobility. We work on specific drills to enhance footwork, but initially, the main focus is to open up their hips and to make sure that they're as healthy as possible so that they can be as explosive as possible without any injury and to be as fast and as mobile as possible, and that's always our focus.
The NFL is obviously a quarterback league. That is the most important position. There are many teams that are constantly looking. In addition to the physical work, you guys also prepare prospects mentally. What are some of the hoops that quarterbacks have to hop through?
Well, with quarterbacks, I mean, we it's a lot of mental preparation. So we do a lot of, from a conditioning standpoint, we do a lot of what we call transverse plane work. We work in a rotational manner, a lot of med ball work. We use a company called Kaiser that has air-based equipment. So we can train the quarterback rotationally so they can learn to have better rotation within their hips, their core, so they rotate to put more velocity on the ball. And then we bring in we have an amazing quarterback team of coaches where we have, you know, Scott Bruner's been with us for years, worked with Joe Flacco, getting ready now for the Super Bowl here. We have Jeff Garcia's our new partner out of Test West down in San Diego. He's a vested partner with us. We're excited about that. And obviously a significant quarterback, played 18 years of professional football. We have Chad Pennington, who was a two-time NFL comeback player of the year, as well as Jay Fiedler. You know, Jay Fiedler played with the Dolphins, the Jets. I mean, just incredible guys that have incredible minds. So we do a lot of classroom work, film work, video review, and just really dialing into what a quarterback's expected. And also leadership qualities. We bring in sports psychologists and everything else to make sure we work on it for every position. But the quarterback position definitely takes a little more, from the mental perspective, in addition to the rotational power that we do. It's very unique to the quarterback position.
That's a very good point. The quarterback position is obviously very cerebral. This week, the big news came out that Jeff Garcia was helping out Jets quarterback Mark Sanchez. There's also rumblings that Jamarcus Russell going to attempt to make a comeback. How do you help a veteran, a guy like Sanchez, who has been in the league, who has had a lot of different coaches, but maybe it all hasn't gelled together as he had hoped? How do you help a guy like that in comparison to a player like Jamarcus Russell, who has been out of the league, trying to scratch and claw their way back in?
Yeah, both very different issues, and I've been fortunate enough to spend a lot of time with both of those guys, and they're going to be reporting to us in the next week or two here. Jamarcus next week in San Diego, I just spent time with him down in Mobile, Alabama with the family, and you know, Mark's trained with us on and off for the last couple of years, but last year not as much. Now we're really getting him to dial in on, you know, the differences really are Mark needs to refine things that he's been working on. He's going to be working on a new offensive system with Marty Morningwig. We have Jeff played with him for 4 or 5 years and had his best couple years in the league were under Marty. So he knows that West Coast offense extremely well. So we're going to work on that. But, you know, also getting Mark up to the fighting weight. You know, he's got to increase his weight and increase his mass, specifically in his lower body. I mean, we've had him as over 230 pounds, 232 pounds. But he can very quickly go down to about 215, 218 if you don't watch it. So we have to really work on getting calories into him, increasing his mass, and then working, obviously, with Jeff on all the positional work. So that's critical. You know, and then with Jamarcus, it's a totally different situation. I mean, you're looking at a guy that's been away from the game for a few years. He's gained a lot of weight. We have to get about 50 pounds off of him. So weight loss is our first task and our first job. And, you know, working with our mental team and bringing guys in like Scott Bruner to work on the board work and, you know, working on all of his study habits. And then Jeff Garcia played with Jamarcus. So he's going to be really a mentor and a driving force. And, you know, one of his best friends is he played with, and he was his leader, was a guy named Mike Clayton. Played 2 years with the Giants recently, and prior to that was 6 years with the Tampa Bay Bucks. Mike's making a comeback as well. So we got an army around Jamarcus to come back. It's a whole different scenario. They're very different situations, but both, you know, very exciting for us. And you know what we're here to do is help guys get better and to perform at their highest level.
Jamarcus Russell, when he came out of LSU, had tons of physical ability. I would anticipate he probably still does when he gets down to the fighting weight that you talked about. Is it harder to totally rebuild and restart like with a guy like Jamarcus Russell, or is that a little bit easier because they're more pliable as opposed to a guy like Mark who has had success in the league and needs more refining?
You know, I think they're both equally challenging in different ways. Obviously, with Jamarcus, there's a few more mountains to climb. But, you know, I think it is a little easier in a sense in that losing weight, if you have a great regimen and a great program, great nutritional plan. You know, we're going to have, you know, we have an incredible Simple Nutrition, and San Diego is an incredible program with Alex, and he, you know, we have different people now that are going to really dial in on that. But you know, at the end of the day, it's on Jamarcus. He's going to have to really focus on eating the right things, drinking the right things, doing the right things at all points. So if he does those things, it's going to become a lot easier. He's very, very naturally blessed. He's got extreme arm strength. He's got extreme athleticism and extreme size. Those are things that, you know, Mark may not have all those things, but Mark is extremely cerebral. He's extremely tough. He's extremely, you know, hardworking. He puts the time in. He just needs to refine some things, get a little bigger, get a little stronger, and really refine that offense to go in. And frankly, you know, the Jets need to surround him with some players. It's not... You know, a lot of people want to point the finger at Mark. There's been a lot of other people, you know, the offensive line, the wide receivers, and even the running backs. I mean, it's not a one-man show out there. So it hasn't. Last year wasn't an easy year for the New York Jets, that's for sure.
That's a very good point. Even a quarterback as great as a guy like Tom Brady or Peyton Manning, if you don't surround them with Wes Welkers and Rob Gronkowski's and a complement of running backs, it makes their job harder.
No doubt about it. I mean, in any situation, it's very easy for the general public to go back and point at these guys and say what they do or what they don't do. You tell me, outside of Santonio Holmes, name the top three receivers for the Jets, please.
I would say Stephen Hill, Chaz Schilens, and Clyde Gates, maybe.
Okay, well, you're a pretty good student. So what is the general public? Do you think they knew any of those names?
The only one I would bet that they may know is Stephen Hill, just because he had that big game week one. But
yeah,
you're right.
You know, so these are good guys. They're good developing young players that are number three or number four receivers on most teams. That's his one and two. So just with that alone, and the offensive line had a tough year. I mean, they're, you know, they're losing guys like Damian Woody and you know, different guys over the last couple of years. I mean, it's been a big change in the Jets program, and everybody wants to point the finger at the quarterback, but at the end of the day, it's a team effort, and what I can tell you is that Mark will be prepared for next year. We're very confident in that. He's going to work his butt off, and he's going to be ready, and hopefully the Jets will be equally ready to bring in the right talent around him to take it to the next level.
That's a very good point. A quarterback is only as good as he has time to make the throws, and the Jets' offensive line has significantly decreased in terms of productivity year after year. When you have a prospect coming in from college that is just a freak, let's say a guy like Patrick Peterson, who is just a tremendous player. I see him in Arizona. I go to Arizona State. I see him play for the Cardinals all the time. How do you make a player like that better when they already have such great physical ability?
Well, Patrick is an absolute freak, like you said. Very blessed by God. Did a lot of great work with his dad, you know, leading up to college and into that process. What we really worked on, we had Otto Bolden as our speed guy, really refine his 40-yard dash. He wanted to really crush that 40, and he really did. He was the performer of the combine when he came out, and he was voted by almost every draft site you can imagine as the number one guy at the combine overall. 4.34 laser time, which is not what he came in at. He was a lot faster with his laser time, and his hand time for teams was in the 4.2s. So at 219 pounds, we worked on opening his hips up, being more flexible, more mobile, sinking his hips a little bit better, lowering his level, and really enhancing his 40-yard dash. And he really crushed all of his testing events, and that was his goal. Our job was to help refine you know, all those skills and drills. And the combine drills are what we're here to do during that process, is to master those tests. And it's, you know, a lot of people think the name of our company is Test because we master the testing, but it's not. It's an acronym for something else. But, you know, we'll take it during that process.
Right.
Those tests are there. There's a system in place to crush those tests, and that's what we're here to help these guys do.
How important are those tests in terms of how good of a football player they are? There, we have all seen players that are workout warriors. Vernon Golson comes to mind. He was a freak at the combine, but he struggled in the league. Do you think that those tests are absolutely important in terms of how good of a player they are, or are they just a hoop similar to taking the SAT in college?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think so. Basically, you know, to answer your question, no, the test itself does not make you a better player. However, the process to enhance the test enhances your athleticism, so therefore helps you become a better player. Does that make sense?
Yeah, exactly.
So, you know, to me, if a guy doesn't run a great 40 and he's a great football player and his film is great, that's what matters. But what the 40-yard dash will do is reinforce that he's a great player and that he has long speed, quote-unquote, to the scouts. You know, if a guy plays as a 4.4 and runs a 4.6, that's a problem. If you see him on film and he looks like a 4.4 guy and he runs a 4.6, it says, well, you know, maybe he's good in quick spaces, but he can't really go long. He can't really cover the deep go route. You know, those are things that they're thinking about. So the 40s and those kinds of things really enhance, basically reinforce, rather, what you are as a player. But some guys, you know, you look at, you know, the Oakland Raiders for years. They're going to take guys a round or two or three higher because the guy has a great 40. So there is about, I'd say, 25 to 30% of the teams in the league that they really look at that. And that 40-yard dash is the pinnacle. And that's why we bring Otto Bolden in to really enhance that. He's the best speed coach in the world. He's an Olympic analyst now for NBC for the Olympics, but he also is a four-time sprint medalist from Trinidad. But in addition to that, you know, to the great scouts that are out there, they want to see a good shuttle. They want to see a good three cone, not necessarily for the time, but they want to see how flexible your hips are, how low you get, what kind of effort you put in during those tests. Are you really into it? Do you really care? You know, those are all things that are part of it. So the good scouts are looking at how the athlete performs in each drill, how their body moves in space, not just to watch.
It's easy to be physically gifted, but if you don't want it, clearly the NFL will chew you up and spit you out with the adversity and the injuries. How do you guys at Test help players that have some injuries that are lingering? Do you guys have a rehab component there as well to increase their recovery time?
Absolutely. We have a full therapy team here. We have a full hot and cold tubs. We have massage therapists. We do everything we can to enhance recovery. We have a strong nutrition plan that's going to help them recover as quickly as possible, as well as we have Inter Armour as a supplementation program that has a lot of amino acids in it and things that help them recover from their workouts. So it's a really multi-pronged approach to make sure that we're enhancing recovery. And we also do yoga, Pilates, flexibility, corrective exercises. I mean, the list goes on and on.
The Test Academy seems like it is the entire my body is my temple way to improving a football player's career. Brian, before we get you out of here, I got to ask you about the Super Bowl. You are in the football world. I'm willing to bet anything that I own that you are a huge football fan. What do you think, or what do you see coming out of the game here?
I see Joe Flacco. That's all I see.
He's played
beyond
tremendous.
That, I can't see anything. No, I'm kidding. You know, I see a tremendous game. I see tremendous athletes on both sides of the ball. I think, you know, hats off to the 49ers and that defense. Their defense is incredible. They're extremely athletic. Colin Kaepernick's been an incredible athlete, made a huge impact in that program and that city. And you know, we've had the fortune of working with Anthony Davis in the past, the tackle, and you know, they got some great, great players. It's going to be an awesome game. But you know, when I look at the Ravens, I think, you know, I take Flacco over Kaepernick, obviously because he's a client of ours. But I also believe that he has some intangibles there and experience in the playoffs and a want to that's really indescribable, and he's always had it. But I also see, you know, a hungry offensive team that's improved tremendously. The defense is aging, but I think they're rallying around Ray Lewis, and I see a very tight game. I see a 24-21 Ravens win.
I tend to agree with you on Joe Flacco. He has played great. Colin Kaepernick has the to mention that Flacco and a lot of other quarterbacks don't with their ability to run, but quarterbacks get paid to throw the football, not just to run it. Thanks a lot for coming on the show. I really appreciate it. Where can people find some information on what you guys are doing?
Yeah, you can find us on the web at testfootballacademy.com. It's test like in school. You can also find us on Twitter at test, all caps, underscore, football. So it's test, underscore, football. Check us out on Twitter. We have all kinds of videos and updates and motivational things, and you'll see some exercises on there for different positions. And, you know, we're here to help the youth. We work with kids 8 years old all the way up through to pros. So, you know, we look forward to working with more football guys in the future. And, you know, we thank you for the time, Mike.
Into fourth down now, I'll give you my take on the college and pro landscape in terms of compensation. Last night, Kentucky star center Narlens Noel tore his left ACL trying to make a hustle play, in the words of Billy Donovan. On a breakaway, Noel tried to jump up and block a shot for his Kentucky team, saving a basket against Florida. Noel landed awkwardly and tore his ACL. He is done for the season. It will be a long rehab process for Noel, who was widely considered the number one overall pick in this year's NBA draft. The injury to Noel is damning for a lot of reasons. First, it will hurt his earning potential, or I should say, could potentially hurt his earnings potential going forward in professional basketball. Some think if Noel comes out, he'll be a top five pick as it is with the torn ACL. He's that good, he's that gifted, and he's that talented. There's a parallel here to be drawn with Jadeveon Clowney, the defensive end extraordinaire for the South Carolina Gamecocks. Clowney considered to be the number one overall pick this year, meaning coming up, not this draft, but the next year's draft. Jason McKee thinks he's a phenomenal player, would be the first overall pick now if he came out. He's that special. Some think Clowney should not play this season because it will hurt his draft stock. They think Clowney should go to a specialist, a facility, similar maybe to a test football academy, prepare for the year, continue to study, watch tapes, improve workout times. But there is really no substitute for reps. There is no substitute for real-life experience. Think about this. In your job, you go to work every day. If you took 6 months off of your job and hopped right back in, inevitably, your performance would drop. So for those that think Jadeveon Clowney should not play, I think they're crazy. For Jadeveon Clowney to go literally 18 months without playing football and to just step in week one and play in the NFL, or I should say week one of training camp, it's absurd. Does he have potential to get injured? Absolutely. It's football. Did Narlens Noel get hurt playing basketball for Kentucky? Absolutely. Did Noel know what he was doing? Did he willingly take that risk? Absolutely. Some out there say Noel should have been able to play in the NBA right now. Get rid of the one-and-done rule. That may or may not be true. That may or may not be valid. That may or may not be right. But here's what many people seem to not grasp. It is not your right to play professional athletics. It is not my right to do a radio show. It is not your right to do whatever you do. So for you to sit there and say the NCAA and the NBA are wrong because they have this rule and that they're taking advantage of the kids. Are colleges making money off student athletes? Absolutely. Students pay tickets to watch games live at Sun Devil Stadium, at Bryant-Denny in the South in Alabama, at the Coliseum in USC, Austin in Oregon. They pay money to go to Rupp Arena and watch Kentucky play. But let's not pretend that the students are not getting something quantifiable out of it, like free room and board, a free education if they choose to take it. Some, like John Wall, chose not to. They went for a semester, dropped out. Ocho Cinco, Chad Johnson, transferred from a junior college to Oregon State, where he allegedly had a 0.00 GPA after the fall semester because he left. He did not care about athletics. He only cared about football. So let's not pretend that colleges are the only ones that are, let's say, using the system to their advantage. Clearly, players are doing it as well. Now, you get a rare player who's a tremendous athlete that decides to stay 4 years, get their degree. It's like Gene Boyd said a couple weeks ago. Student athletes that graduate get paid more, regardless of their field, whether it's the NBA, NFL. So, let's not pretend that Noel was taken advantage of in some way, that Jadeveon Clowney was taken advantage of in some way. They know the risks of the game. Will Nerlens Noel, is it possible he'll never play again? Theoretically, I guess it's possible. With medical technology, highly unlikely. Will he be the same player? Who knows? Adrian Peterson came back pretty well. No problems. In fact, had his best season rushing the football. There have been players that come back from knee injuries and they're done. They're devastated. All we have to do is look at Greg Oden of Ohio State, formerly of the Portland Trailblazers. Think about making a comeback next season. Injuries have crushed his career. So let's not pretend here that athletes don't know the risks, because they do. Now, we could debate whether or not they're getting equal compensation for what they're giving, but that's not my point here. My point here is for a guy like Jadeveon Clowney to sit there and say, I'm not going to play, or consider I'm not going to play, is that a guy you want on your team? A guy that only thinks about himself? Is that a guy you're taking with the first overall pick? Give me Noel every day of the week and twice on Sunday. He's a guy that, on a breakaway against a guard, tried everything he possibly could, gave his body up, put it on the line, tried to make a play. He's a guy you want on your team. Injuries happen, and they're tragic for a player. No one wants to see anybody tear their ACL. No one wants to see a horrific knee injury like Willis McGahee's. If you haven't seen it, YouTube it if you want to. It is devastating. Or Marcus Lattimore. That is sad. And injuries are part of the game. And what's to say that they won't become a professional and tear their ACL, MCL, and their career will be over? There's tons of athletes that have gone broke because their career was not nearly as long as they wanted. Ultimately, here's my point. If you are Jadeveon Clowney and you don't want to get hurt, my suggestion to you would be play and hope you don't get hurt. Because saving your health for the sake of your draft stock inevitably will do damage to your draft stock. Is that not a red flag? I'm not going to play. For Mr. Noel at Kentucky, I hope he has a speedy recovery. But, those are the risks of the game. If you don't want to possibly get hurt, don't play. And that'll be the show for tonight. If you'd like to get in touch with me, you could find me on Twitter at FifthDownMike. The show is on iTunes. You can search my name, Michael Fiella, or the show name, The Fifth Down. You can also email the show, fifthdowncfb@gmail.com. Thanks for downloading us.